This episode is sponsored by Kinsta. Between juggling client meetings, managing your website, and keeping up with everyday tasks, who has the time to stress out about website security? Well, with Kinsta, the technical stuff is taken care of, so you can focus on what you do best. Kinsta provides managed hosting for WordPress, offering lightning-fast load times, top-tier security, and unmatched human-only customer support. Whether you're a business owner, web developer, or running a digital agency, Kinsta makes managing your website easy and efficient. Kinsta provides enterprise-grade security, being one of the few hosting providers for WordPress with SOC 2 and other certifications, guaranteeing the highest level of security for your website. Thanks to their unlimited free expert-led migrations, Kinsta ensures a smooth transition for you from other hosting providers. Customers have reported 200% faster load times post-migration to their platform. What I find cool about Kinsta is their fast and reliable customer service and premium features that are included at no extra cost. Ready to experience Kinsta's hosting for yourself? Get your first month free when you sign up at Kinsta.com today. That's Kinsta.com. This episode is brought to you by Propel Auth. People take authentication for granted, but it's more than how customers log into your product. It's how you manage your relationship with your users. The easiest way to make authentication your advantage is to use Propel Auth. Propel Auth is more than just functional. It's powerful. With tools like managed UIs, enterprise SSO, robust user management features, and actionable insights, Propel Auth adapts as your product grows. And the best part? When Auth is effortless, your team can focus on scaling, not troubleshooting. That means more releases, happier customers, and more growth for your business. Save dev time, win over your customers, and propel your business forward with Propel Auth. Check them out at propelauth.com. That's PropelAuth.com.
Engineers aren't the buyer, right? They don't control the keys to the cloud kingdom. This thing can be great for them, but it's going to attach to your cloud. And as soon as that happens, it's an operational concern. And so as we're talking to these companies, the ops teams, all of a sudden, they're like, wait a second, can we put our own modules in this? And we're like, no, it's not like that. Like, you guys don't need to do this anymore. It would be really cool if we could put our own in this, and then our engineers could just diagram like our infrastructure. So we're like, nah, that's a crazy idea. And then after about 15 people told us this in a row, we're like, oh, maybe we should just let people upload their own modules to it and then let their engineers diagram. That was our like unlocking moment. I'm Corey O'Daniel, CEO and co-founder of MassDriver.
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
Took 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing at the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know what to do next.
Took many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
The company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve.
Most proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a pain.
Yes, we've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time. The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, Mike.
Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want it.
It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story. I'm your host, Noah Labhart. And today, how Corey O'Daniel is building DevOps without the red tape. That's fast by default and safe by design. This episode is sponsored by Speakeasy. Grow your API user adoption and improve engineering velocity with friction-free integration experiences. With Speakeasy's platform, you can now automatically generate SDKs in 10 languages and Terraform providers in minutes. Visit speakeasy.com/codestory and generate your first SDK for free. This message is sponsored by QA Wolf. QA Wolf gets engineering teams to 80% automated end-to-end test coverage and helps them ship 5 times faster by reducing QA cycles from hours to minutes. With over 100 five-star reviews on G2 and customer testimonials from SalesLoft, Drata, and AutoTrader, you're in good hands. Join the Wolfpack at QAWolf.com. Corey O'Daniel has had an interesting path to technology, growing his career in a number of cloud architect roles at Ripple, Deal Science, and The RealReal. He's had rich experience in DevOps, the cloud, and platform engineering, But outside of tech, he's married with two kids living in Southern California. He loves driving and destroying RC cars, like the ones that go 65 to 70 miles per hour. He jumps them off a lot of ramps, his highest jump being 20 feet upwards, which, of course, he landed. Corey noticed that there is a huge knowledge gap regarding the cloud, especially during his time doing professional services. He would leave a project post-completion and see a major gap in how the client understood what was built. He and his co-founders had the idea to build a product to allow platform engineers to diagram their infra and fuel developers' engineering process. This is the creation story of MassDriver.
Why we built MassDriver is there's this huge knowledge gap. There's not a ton of engineers that have deep cloud experience, right? But everything we're building, we're putting in the cloud. I was working in professional services and I was just seeing this time and time again. It's like we go in, we work with these companies, we'd help them build stuff out. And there'd just be this massive knowledge gap when we left. It's like, how did the thing work, right? You're taking these companies where people have been working in data centers for years, and all of a sudden they're like a junior Terraform engineer, right? Different skill set, just different world versus racking servers and running cables and administering Linux, right? There was this big lift that they had to do to even understand how these systems worked. When you start moving beyond just like automating your infrastructure and moving into things like self-service, that's where a lot of these companies fall apart, right? Like when you look at any cloud API, half of it has operational concerns and half of it has developer concerns. You look at something like a database, right? Ops cares about the zones and the replication and the backups, and devs care about, is it Postgres or MySQL? What version is it? What parameters are set on it that are hyper-tuned to like my workload? You have this like split concern of every single one of these APIs. And what's hard about it is you're always shifting more and more onto developers' plates as they start to adopt infrastructure automation. And so our idea was to essentially build a tool that would let your operations teams build the perfect platform for your developers using operational tooling. Operations teams don't have to learn anything new. Like they've got a ton of stuff on their plate as it is. But also developers that need this infrastructure don't have to learn the ops tools. Everybody's got too much stuff to do to be learning entire new tool sets all day long. With MathDriver, you just take your Terraform modules. We're one of the companies behind OpenTofu. You can take OpenTofu modules, Helm. You essentially build all of your practices like right into those modules around compliance, all of your company's non-negotiables. Publish it into our platform, and then developers just diagram the cloud architectures they need. So it's literally, it is a diagramming interface. They diagram, okay, I've got an application, some databases. And as they're diagramming the system, it's grabbing all those modules that your ops team has built and doing all the provisioning, compliance scanning, and et cetera, behind the scenes. So developers don't have to learn enough Terraform to get themselves in trouble when a PR fails because they did something wrong, right? They just diagram and they're getting exactly what the operations team pre-approved for them to build.
Tell me about the MVP of MassDriver, that first version of the product you built. How long did it take to build and what sort of tools were you using to bring it to life?
I worked for a company in like 2005, 2006, and we had a data center. I was the only developer at this company that had worked in a data center previously and was also a software developer. There was this little bookstore that was going to start selling these cloud computers, this company called Amazon. The lease on our colo is expiring in a couple of months. Amazon's doing this cloud thing. You're going to lead the migration. And I was like, none of the words you just said make any sense to me whatsoever. As a person that likes to automate, I'm very test driven. The first thing I did was like, if we're not going to have real physical machines, like I need to figure out how to automate this so we can reproduce stuff. And so I built this tool years ago that I open sourced, and that was like the root of MassDriver. So I open sourced it, ended up leaving the company a few years later, and I just tinkered on this thing over time. I never ended up pushing it back to Git because it was a different Git repo. Me and my co-founder, Dave, are just sitting around one day. We're working on a side project and we got our first MVP built. And I'm like, do you want to do the DevOps bits? We're both engineers with like tons of ops experience. I'm like, do you want to write the Terraform and set up all the cloud shit? No, like, you do that. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. And we're sitting there looking at each other like, holy crap. Like, this whole industry has this massive gap of experience in the cloud. We have two people that have a ton of experience in it, and neither of us want to do it because we want to do the interesting work of building the product. So I whip out what is or was MassDriver at the time, didn't even have a UI on it yet. And I show it to him and he's like, this is cooler than what we've built. Two people that know this stuff would rather be working on software than like rethinking about how to configure databases for the 400th time. If we can put a graphing layer on this to literally make it easy where anybody can manage cloud without that deep expertise, like we might have something. Neither of us were front-end engineers, to say the least, or engineers that could build like a nice graphing layer. So the very first version of MassDriver, I think Dave threw together the UI in a week or two. It was a sight to behold. It was funny. We were working together at The Real at the time with one of my best friends, Chris Hill, who's one of our other co-founders. And he's hardcore ops guy on the back end. Kubernetes networking's his thing. And so we're like, hey, like we need somebody, like somebody else to join that's just got like deep experience on like the networking side and whatnot. And we show it to him and he's like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever seen. I would never use this. And I'm like, yeah, that's the point. Look at where we work. Look how many engineers you serve. There's three people on the ops team. There's 150 software developers. You write all the Terraform for them. Like you do all the stuff because like, they just don't have the time to learn it. As soon as he saw, this is literally a tool that lets me like enforce the rules we need to without forcing everybody else to learn my tools, which just creates more work for me. So he was just like, I'm in. And so that was how we kicked it off. We quit our jobs almost immediately. Lit an entire pile of cash on fire from our retirements trying to get this thing off the ground, and then stumbled backwards into YC. It was right around COVID hitting. We never even thought about applying to YC. Like it just, I've been remote for 15 years. So I'm like, I'm not moving to San Francisco and sleeping in a shack with 85 other dudes. Like that's just not my MO. One of my friends was like, oh, you should apply to YC. I'm like, yeah, we're not doing that. And then he's like, it's remote now. And I was like, oh. So we applied to YC a week late, like a week after the deadline, but they still accept applications. It's like December 28th and we get a call back. Like the batch is starting like January 9th or something like that. This is wild. And they're like, there's one spot left. So like we would go from, we don't care about this thing. It's not going to happen to, ah, we'll apply. It's still probably not going to happen to, there's one spot left. Like they call us first off, like anxiety through the roof. And then they're like, one spot left. And now we're just like, this is like, we got to get this last spot. You go through the interview, you do your little minute video, demoing the product and pitching the idea. And then they usually let you know like same day or like next day if you're in or not. And we're so close to the start date. We do our interview. We rehearse it just enough where it doesn't sound rehearsed. We're not like stuttering, right? We do our interview and we don't get a call back. And we're like, whatever. We'll just continue burning our own money. And then about a day later, they reach out to us and they're like, hey, can we do your interview again? And we're like, what does that mean? Like now we're just like, what is going? There's one spot left. They want us to interview again. So we go back and we interview again. And we're just like, okay, this is so weird. It's like deja vu 2 days later, interview again. And then that night they reach out to us and they're like, you guys are in if you want it. What ended up happening was there was one spot left, but the group leads that interviewed us liked us. They wanted us, but they had just accepted one of our competitors into the same group. They don't put competitors in the same group. So then we had to like, they had to shift some stuff around and then put us with another group. So we had to interview with them and they liked us too. So I guess we've been admitted to YC twice.
This message is sponsored by SnapTrade. Link in user brokerage accounts and build world-class investing experiences with SnapTrade's unified brokerage API. With over $12 billion in connected assets and over 300,000 connected accounts, SnapTrade's API quality and developer experience are second to none. SnapTrade is SOC 2 certified and uses industry-leading security practices. Developers can use the company's official client SDKs to build investing experiences in minutes without the limitations of traditional aggregators. Get started for free today by visiting snaptrade.com/codestory.
I'm so pumped about my new offshore dev partner. I'm saving a ton, and they even signed an NDA. Wait, is that our financial statements on the internet?
My dev partner has great communication. They can acknowledge an issue or email message super fast after they run it through Google Translate, of course.
I have a call set up with my partner right now. Hey, guys. Guys, are you there? Wait, did you just ghost me?
Ever been in these situations? Yeah, me too. That is, until I found Tekla.
Tekla is world-class, near-shore talent for technology teams who demand the highest standards. The platform gives you access to over 50,000 vetted Latin America technology experts, including developers, designers, and IT professionals, all fluent in English and all in your time zone. In 7 days or less, you can have your tech expert hired through Tekla's fast, efficient hiring process, which helps you find and onboard top candidates. Get senior-level talent at competitive rates, often half the cost of hiring in the U.S., but aligned with U.S. work culture and time zones, making teamwork easy and productive. Hire the best tech experts today with Tekla. Learn more at tekla.io. That's T-E-C-L-A.io. This episode is sponsored by Speakeasy. Whether you're growing the user adoption of your public API or streamlining internal development, SDKs can turn the chore of API integration into effortless implementation. Unburden your API users from guessing their way around your API while keeping your team focused on your product. Shorten the time to live integration and provide a delightful experience for your customers. With Speakeasy's platform, you can now automatically generate up-to-date, robust, idiomatic SDKs in 10 languages and Terraform providers in just a matter of minutes. SDKs are feature-rich with type safety, auto-retries, and pagination, everything you need to give your API the developer experience it deserves. Deliver a premium API experience without the premium price tag. Visit speakeasy.com/codestory to get started and generate your first SDK for free. Okay, so you got into YSD, you were successful there, you came out of it. Let's go from that point. So you've got the product, YC, and then how have you matured the product from there is what I'm interested in. How did you mature it and progress it? And I'm curious about roadmap. Like, how do you put that together? How do you go about deciding this is the next most important thing to build or to address with MassDriver?
One of the first things we did was we took a lot of the YC advice and we just threw it out the window. And they were like, okay, I understand why they told us not to do that. YC is an interesting place. There's a ton of value in it. And I think one of the things that people get really excited about or entrenched in is like cross-selling. Like, one of the things is like the network effect. Like, there's people that you can talk to, share experiences, but like you can also sell your software to each other, right? Especially as a dev tool. And we're like, man, what a place to land. We start going into all these companies and we're pitching other folks in YC. And every single sales call you set up with YC, it's literally both teams trying to sell each other on the thing that they have. I picked this up after 3 sales calls. I'm like, oh, this is a waste of time. This is not how we're going to grow this business. And MassDriver, when it first started, it was a slightly different tool. We were selling to engineers. We had a bunch of pre-built infrastructure modules already, met compliance and security baselines and whatnot. And so we were trying to sell to engineers. But like selling to people in YC, it's like they're all trying to build their MVPs. Like, they're not concerned with security and compliance and best practices. They're concerned with getting shit out the door, right? And so it was very obvious to us, like, this wasn't our audience. So we're like, okay, so we got to figure out like how to sell this thing. So we like go back to the drawing board. So it's like, we got the product. We started reaching out to bigger organizations, looking for design partners, looking for base user interviews, like about like, what their problems were. And we're trying to use that as like a wedge of like, hey, what are your problems? Talking about it. It's like, we've already got this thing built. We've been in this space. Like, we know what the problems are. And that worked. It was very interesting. That worked. It worked very well. So we went from $0 of revenue to almost like just shy of $500,000 in about 10 weeks, which was like just rocket fuel. We're going to be Series D by the end of the year. Let's ring that bell. Like, we're like, everything is going right. The entire startup journey is just, it's a roller coaster. Like, when you're at your lowest low, I had my lowest low 6 weeks ago. I'm on top of the world right now. Looking back, like the biggest thing that you get out of that group is the support. But we were on top of the world, like going through YC, reaching out to people, talking about what their problems were, and then showing them MassDriver. And what we kept getting was this interesting place where we maxed out at around this like $500,000 mark. Like, we couldn't get anybody else. And we're like, okay, we may have just luckily been unlucky. Like, we happened to hit the right amount of people to buy this thing, but not enough market for the way that we're marketing it. The way that we were marketing it was like, hey, it's this really easy tool to like get infrastructures up and running quickly. Like, we had all these pre-built modules that were in it, but like, there was no bring your own modules at this point in time. Like, it was us saying, hey, people don't like writing all this Terraform. So Chris is going to go and build modules for every single cloud provider. And it's just a GUI for essentially getting infrastructure as code. And so what we were seeing was these other companies, they'd come in, their engineering teams would love it. Engineers aren't the buyer, right? They don't control the keys to the cloud kingdom, right? Like, this thing could be great for them, but it's going to attach to your cloud. And as soon as that happens, it's an operational concern. Like, DevOps team wants to talk, security team wants to talk, lawyers want to know about compliance, right? Like, it really grinds that sales process to a halt. And so as we're talking to these companies that are like engineering teams, like, yes, I want this thing. Ops teams, no way in hell. The ops teams, all of a sudden, they're like, wait a second, can we put our own modules in this? And we're like, nah, it's not like that. Like, you guys don't need to do this anymore. Like, we got all the modules in here. And they're like, it would be really cool if we could put our own in this. And then our engineers could just diagram like our infrastructure instead of like using all these pre-built ones. And we're like, nah, that's a crazy idea. And then after about 15 people told us this in a row, we're like, oh, maybe we should just let people upload their own modules to it and then let their engineers diagram. That was our like unlocking moment. So like, we literally had this shift. We're selling this to engineers as an alternative to Heroku, where they can get like all these other services that they need in the cloud, and it's running in your cloud and you're using your cloud credits. This is a tool for operations teams to cut the red tape around DevOps and infrastructure requests. That was when we started to really see interest from the people that could actually buy this in bigger organizations. Came out of YC, like we had that 400 and something K that we sold in 10 weeks, and it was great. Like, we did our YC pitch, 1 minute long. I get off the stage, I'm gonna throw air quotes on that because it was all virtual. And within about 5 minutes, we had, I think it was 175 VCs reach out to us, which was interesting because before YC, I had 120 something VCs tell me to get bent and that my idea sucked. No way in hell, dude. Get out of here. And now all these people are coming back and they're like, oh, so that's like the next part of the journey though, is like, okay, now I've got people that like, I told them the story. I told them the problem. They didn't buy it. And now there's money and now they'll believe anything where there's some green. That's also not the relationship I want. I understand VC is hard. Like, you can't just invest in something because you love the idea. You got to invest in it because it's a good business. But I was put off by it. We went on this hunt of trying to find the right VC for us out of this pool of about a bajillion people that reached out to us. And what I ended up finding was I found this guy runs a fund called 1984. And he had been in our shoes before. Like, he had been in our space. He had been an operations engineer. And so it was like actually talking to somebody that like got it was really exciting. I think the serendipitous moment with that was my calendar was just so crazy at the time between sales calls and like VC meetings. They were bringing in one other company, Uncorrelated, also an operator who'd been in the space. He's been in the space a long time. He was on my calendar and it was so late in the day that I, for some reason, I thought he was a sales call. I didn't realize he was a VC until like he joined on Google Meet. I do all my pitches in the morning when I have energy. I'm like looking at my keyboard and I'm like, I realize what I've done. I'm like, I've just messed this up. So I look up at him. I'm like, look, man, it's been a long day. I've talked to a lot of VCs. I've been on a lot of sales calls. I thought you were a potential customer. I'm just not in the mindset to do a pitch right now. But if you want, I was like, I'll go through my sales demo with you. And he's like, yeah, I want to see that. But again, like, he was an operator, right? And so I give him the sales pitch. And then Rami from 1984 emails me like an hour later. And we're both in.
I'm curious about team. Like, how do you go about building your team? How did you go about building your team? And what do you look for in those people to indicate that they're the winning horses to join you?
We're seven people. It was really funny. We were a sponsor at reInvent this year. And I met one of the folks from Gitpod. So they were over checking out our booth and we're just talking on the side. And it was one of the guys that worked on that recent like Kubernetes change that they had. He goes, oh, he's like, how big is your company? And I'm like, oh, it's just seven of us, including the sales guy. You've built all of this with just six people. That is insane. What's even more insane is we actually have a professional services arm that goes along with MassDriver. And the whole thing is just six people. I wrote an article a few years ago called DevOps is Bullshit, and it made a lot of people mad, but we embrace a ton of DevOps principles here. I think a lot of the industry has bastardized the idea, but we lean into automation everywhere. MassDriver runs on MassDriver. Like, I can open up a graph, I can migrate the database that it's running on. That's pretty wild. the amount of power that we've extended to the few people on our team that don't have experience managing cloud, like they can build stuff on their own quickly. Dave and I, both hardcore, like behavioral-driven design, domain-driven design, test-driven design, like all the letters before the DD. And so we've just got a lot of automation built in. We just fly. Like we build fast, we ship fast. We don't harp over infrastructure constantly because we're just able to diagram it. And so we've managed to stay small. Now, like how we hire, I think one of the big mistakes we made was during that heyday where we're like, oh, we're going through the moon right now. This is great. We actually scaled up pretty big. I think we scaled up to like 11 people or something like that. It definitely had some people that were great, some people that weren't fits for the organization. We scaled up so fast because we thought we had to, that all of a sudden we realized like there's not, like we actually slowed down because there was just so many levels of communication now, so much coordination. There were people that just literally had nothing to do. And so we scaled back down and it was painful. Like it was hard. It sucks to let people go. It was a financial burden because the severances, right? So we brought people on. It was like, oh, we just grew too fast. Like we need to scale this back down to just a small team and make sure we understand what we built. But there was a lot of expenditures and cash around that mistake, which also sucks as a business. But we got back down to a small team and now we're just like, we're at this cadence again that we're crushing it. As far as like when we decide to hire now, we're not looking for any of us to be burnt out, but we want to get to a point where somebody on the team is, I can't do this job. Not the whole job, but like a job. Like this is just like outside my wheelhouse and I can't learn it and I don't have enough time to, right? Like really reaching that point of like, there needs to be another body here. Not, I couldn't learn this today, so we're going to hire somebody to do it, which is where we were. It's like, oh, like how do we do outbound? I don't know. Well, okay, we'll hire somebody to do it. What we found out with our business is like, ops people don't read emails. I've never bought anything from an email. Like it's a waste of our time. Like why even be doing outbound? Our interview process, I think, is actually pretty interesting. I don't believe in whiteboard interviews. I think algorithm interviews are an absolute waste of everybody's time. I think it's showboaty. And I honestly, when I was in the market, I wouldn't do them. If I went in and somebody's like, we're doing an algorithm, I'd be like, I'm out. Tapped out. I'm done. Like you can come up with a different way of interviewing me, but like, if this is it, if this is how you're making the decision, I don't want to work with your team. Like I'm out. And the reason why is because it doesn't test any of the things that are important about being a software developer. And so we have kind of three things that we're looking for. We're looking to see what it's actually like to work with you. We're looking to see like how reasonable you can be about a decision and can you actually do the work? And so our interview process is very straightforward. I think we make a decision in less than 3 hours from deciding to talk to somebody. We usually get offers out same day. And I've been doing this process for about maybe like a decade or so. Most companies, when they interview, you come in having no idea what your interview is going to be like. And so number one is when you come in for the interview, I have no idea what the interview is. I'm looking for that inversion of control. I want that power disbalance, but I want it to be in your favor. And so what we do is we email people when they're coming in for their interview and we say, hey, what we're going to do is we're going to do a coding exercise. And depending on what job they're going for, so MassDriver is written in Elixir and Golang. So if somebody is interviewing for the API, it'd be an Elixir. If they're working on like a provisioning engine, it'd be Golang. And we say, okay, Elixir or Golang, like whatever side of the house you're going to be on, pick something in the open source community in this language that is of interest to you and maybe something you're using today. Find an open issue or something about it you don't like or a bug, research it as much as you want, get the test suite working for that library. Please don't do any code, show up and we're going to work together on the problem. You are now the subject matter expert coming in and it is my first day on the job. And that's the test. What is it going to be like when somebody joins when you know everything that there is to know? And so when the person comes in, they get to pick whether they pair program or not. If they decide they want to pair program versus us like shoulder surf them, they get to pick if they want to do ping pong or like navigator driver. So I've had interviews with people where they don't code at all and I'm doing all the coding, but they're my brain. They're talking through the idea with me. I'm their fingers. I'm typing. I've had other ones where we're doing ping pong. I write a test. They make the code work. They write a test. I make the code work. You're actually feeling that communication with them. You're seeing how they think through problems. The most interesting thing is the problem that they show up with. Like, we make decisions based off of that. And I think making a decision based off of the problem that they showed up with is more valuable than making a decision whether somebody got an algorithm right or not. So if somebody shows up and they're like, hey, okay, you're an e-commerce company and you're written in Elixir, and what they show up with is some weird gaming thing in Elixir. Okay, you pick something you're interested in. That tells me something about you. Like, you're going to be chasing things that you're interested in. You didn't take the scope of the business into account here. I've also had people come in, and this was probably the bravest person I've ever had this type of interview with. It was at a company called Stack Commerce, maybe 9 or 10. Jeez, it may have been even longer than that now. She comes in, she sits down, and I'm like, what are we working on? And I can't even remember the library name, but she just goes, I'm using this library, and it's great. I don't really have anything that we can change in it. And I'm like, you just failed. She's like, but the documentation sucks. I just want to go through and build a bunch of really good examples and docs for this. And I was like, you know what? She's hired to walk into a company where this is the interview and be like, look, I don't have anything I want to code. I want to make the docs in this experience better. I was like, there's not a lot of 10X engineers in the world, but that mentality is as close to it as it comes. We do that. And then at the end, it's like, what was that experience like working with them? As the new person coming to the team, the interviewer, what was it like to work with this person that was the subject matter expert? Do you feel like a new person joining the team would benefit from working with them? And that's the decision that we make.
This message is sponsored by QA Wolf. If slow QA processes bottleneck your software engineering team and you're releasing slower because of it, you need a solution. You need QA Wolf. QA Wolf gets engineering teams to 80% automated end-to-end test coverage and helps them ship 5 times faster by reducing QA cycles from hours to minutes. With over 100 five-star reviews on G2 and customer testimonials from SalesLoft, Drata, AutoTrader, and many more, you're in good hands. Ready to ship faster with fewer bugs? Join the Wolfpack at QAWolf.com to see if they can help you squash the QA bottleneck. This episode is sponsored by Vanta. You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority. But to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors. But they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. And that's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How, you ask? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted experts to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstar startups, who trust Vanta. For a limited time, get $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/codestory. That's vanta.com/codestory. This message is sponsored by SnapTrade. Link in user brokerage accounts and build world-class investing experiences with SnapTrade's unified brokerage API. With over $12 billion in connected assets and over 300,000 connected accounts, SnapTrade's API quality and developer experience are second to none. SnapTrade is SOC 2 certified and uses industry-leading security practices. Developers can use the company's official client SDKs to build investing experiences in minutes without the limitations of traditional aggregators. Get started for free today by visiting snaptrade.com/codestory. Okay, let's flip to scalability. And I'm certain, you know, given all of your history, you have scalability knowledge for days. So I'm curious if there are any interesting areas where you've had to fight scalability.
I think one of my more interesting scalability stories, I worked for this travel company. It's actually where my co-founder Chris and I met. The way the product worked was, it was this, I don't want to say search engine, it's not quite the right word. It was a tool that integrated into the front end of almost every travel site on the planet. If you went to their site and you did like that, like city or airport search, a lot of the autocomplete would come from this service. And essentially like the price comparisons would come from this service. We're literally like writing billions of records to our database a month. Our Postgres database, single instance, man, that thing ran so well. Postgres, baby. our software was actually interesting. So it was a snippet that you would toss into these travel sites. And we had a white glove team that would do all the integrations and all the customization for the company. And the reason why is at these bigger scale companies where their homepage is like where they make their money, it just takes them forever to make changes. And if you're a third party vendor, getting them to change something can take months. And so decision of the business was like, we'll get them to put the snippet in as a part of like the sales process and integrating with them. And then we'll just have a team do all the coding so that we can get stuff through. Somebody on our team broke the homepage of one of the big ones. And we had a financial SLA, and the CEO of that company called our CEO and was like, hey, this can't happen again. He turns around to the ops team and he's like, how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? Which is like me, Chris, and one other guy. And I was like, what do you mean by never? Never's a lot of nines. What do you mean by never? It's like, because each one of those nines costs a lot more money. He's like, never as in not ever again. And I'm like, okay. I was like, just a heads up. I was like, when you switch from nines to a one and some zeros, I was like, the cost goes up a lot. He's like, the financial SLA costs us a lot. And I was like, okay. We went and we built this system for essentially tracking like real-time interactions on these sites to essentially assert whether or not a release of ours is breaking something in production systems of other people's. This requires a lot of interacting with the web page, like figuring out what's going on, and then sending all this data back, going through some machine learning pipelines. I don't think we used the word AI back then to detect anomalies. And so we're effectively looking at everything that was happening in the browser around our module. And so it's looking at, okay, what JavaScript errors are dumping. Since our newest version of our module is put in, were more errors produced? Are we producing these errors, or is it coming from something else? It's other people's web pages, so the console logs are insane. Sometimes the issue isn't throwing errors. Sometimes it's moving a button off the page and you can't click on it anymore. And so we're measuring like interactions on the page, like all this telemetry data around like how users are interacting with these arbitrary web pages and sending it back to us. And so we're writing like something crazy, like a few hundred gigs an hour of data that we're writing, and then running these anomaly detection things in the back end to detect, did we break something that we just shipped? And it's hard because there's different media queries, different browser sizes, different browsers, different browser versions. There's so much stuff that can go wrong in a browser, especially when it's not your website. About a month or two later, we end up rolling it out to the entire network of companies. And when we built this, we thought it was just going to be on this one company, right? Because they're huge. But then it was like, hey, like everybody wants this little support pack thing. Let that on. So all of a sudden it got really expensive, like really expensive. And so the blog post is about cutting our API gateway costs because it was all built on Lambda. And so the API gateway cost alone, no storage, no Lambdas, no events, was $32,000 a month. And it was funny because when we built the thing, we're like, oh, sweet, this will all fit in the free tier. But we didn't realize that they were going to roll it out to like the whole network. And so then all of a sudden we had a cost problem. And it was funny because we all of a sudden it went from, well, by never, I didn't mean never. You got to look at your systems. Like you got to think about like how much the thing's going to cost. If the service costs $5 million to run, then it only makes us $2 million a year. Like that service is worthless, right? But we had to keep this thing up. And so we had to go back through and like figure out like, how do we cut this down? And massive scale that we didn't plan for because we didn't think it was going to be rolled out network-wide. We thought it was just going to go to one customer. And so now we have to handle just a catastrophic scale without breaking any of these sites at the same time and dramatically reduce the costs. I had been working in Elixir on another project at the company at the time. And so I'm like, okay, like HTTP processing, easy in Elixir. Like there's some events that we need to route, can pull out a lot of the Lambda stuff. And so over about 2 days, we rebuilt the front end of this API, essentially like all the request handling, cut over from the serverless and API gateway stuff they were running on. Just ended up running it in a couple of Elixir nodes on Kubernetes. Now, the catch here is we already had a big Kubernetes footprint. Like we're all Kubernetes experts. We've been running it at scale for a while. So this wasn't a big like hop for us to go stand up a Kubernetes thing too. Just looking at the API costs alone, $32,000. Like once we'd cut this over to server full, running on something like Elixir, it ended up running on about $100 of compute, $100 to $300 of compute a month.
That's the appeal of serverless. It's infinite scale. Like, I can go to zero or I can go to NAN. The reality is, like, the cost scales with it and really fast. We were lucky that it was such a small service. It was a single API endpoint. And that's the other thing that's crazy about this. This is a single API endpoint, like, that costs this much money. And so it wasn't much for us to refactor and pull out, but it was like, we need to handle this scale. This is a system that itself can never go down. That was the appeal of doing it in serverless, is like, we can't let this thing go down. And so we rewrote it in Elixir, but then we had all the same guarantees that we got to drop the 100% uptime. We ended up going to like 5 nines or something like that, I think was the requirement. So it's like, we had to build that. And so luckily between Kubernetes and Elixir, there's a ton of resiliency there. But we had to design a lot of stuff around like how we backed off passing the messages, like how we queued things. But like a lot of the infiniscale of serverless was all of a sudden like on us. And we were able to stamp it out over a couple of days, cut those costs pretty dramatically. But at the end of the day, Elasticsearch was still getting a big old check.
Okay, so as you step out on the balcony and you look across all that you've built with MassDriver, what are you most proud of?
You know what? I think the thing I'm most proud of, our team is awesome. A lot of my team is friends I've had for years, or friends of friends, right? Our sales guy and my co-founder have been buds since college. Like, it's fun to be able to build something that's like, A, fun to build, fun to use, right? It's not like we're building some dusty e-commerce thing for the 800th time, right? Like, we're building something that's like novel and new. It's fun seeing people excited about it. Like, people at reInvent were just like jaw-dropped at like how we're able to do things. But I think the thing that's most exciting for me about what we built, and the thing that I'm most proud of, is just the pure efficiency of it all. We have several hundred companies running their infrastructure through MassDriver, and a lot of the people that we sold the platform to very early on didn't have ops teams. And many of them still don't, right? There's going to be a point in time where they need an ops team. Like, you need operations. It's important. But one of our goals in our business was allow you to push that out and make that first hire, when you do hire your ops person, not miserable. As an ops person that's joined many teams, and the first ops person that comes in, that's one of the hardest jobs in engineering. You come into an org that's been around for 5 years. They've never had anybody like dedicated to ops and DevOps and like these principles, right? Managing the cloud. And so you usually walk into like waist deep debt, right? And you usually when they hire that first ops person, it's because some shit's gotten real bad. Right. And so you're usually walking into frustrated people, slow pipelines, fragile environments. So one of our kind of promises to early companies was like, look, A, you can push out that first ops hire, because it also hurts for the business. Right. If I got five engineers and I'm about to go do my Series A and I have to hire somebody to do operations, that's a big piece of my budget. And it might not be somebody that's shipping product. And I might not have 40 hours of work. My other option is to go to a professional services firm. But like, they generally hand you a black box, like you got something, but you don't know how it works. And you hope the guy that comes along in the future is going to like it. We were able to tell these companies, like, look, you're going to be able to push that out until you actually need ops. But more importantly, you'll be able to push it out to where you can hire two people at once, because you've pushed it out so far. And when they walk in day one, what they're going to walk into is infrastructure as code, an environment with parity, compliance, like security baselines, like the stuff that they're freaking out about day one. And what you're going to be able to do is you're going to give them a relatively debt-free environment to walk into that is already built using the tools that they probably know, Terraform, OpenTofu, Helm, et cetera. And now that person's first day on the job gets to be about, how can I add incremental value to this business, which ops people aren't often put in the position to do, versus how do I get these people out from underwater? That is just such an awesome experience. And what's been wild about it is some of our customers, our first customer just re-signed for their third or fourth year in a row, and they still haven't hired an ops engineer. Our first big customer just signed for their third year in a row. They had two ops people when they joined MassDriver. They have scaled to over 100x their size. They have not increased the size of that team. And so being able to see these ops teams and these engineering teams get amazing uptime, like this agility and like confidence in their systems, without being forced into hiring somebody too early and that person having a bad experience like joining, or forcing a engineering team to hire 4 ops people instead of their 2 because there's just so much fire to fight, I think is probably one of the most exciting things. We're actually seeing that our product can do the thing that we always aimed for it to do, which was scale operational efficiency.
Okay, so let's flip the script a little bit. Tell me about a mistake you made and how you and your team responded to it.
So early on, we had this advisor. We ended up parting ways, but he was a great guy. He got us to where we needed to go. We're not like tapping on him for advisory as much anymore, so it's probably not a good fit. You need a good set of advisors and investors around you when you're building a startup, not just investors. Find your advisors. Make deals with them that work for them. Like, you're not going to keep them around forever. You keep them around until like you've gotten what you need out of them. And then you need to bring in the advisors for the next stage of where your business is. I remember at the time he was coaching us through like how to do outreach to investors. And he's known for the ability to build up excitement around your fundraising, right? Like, even if it's your first email out to a VC, you need to make it feel like it's one of your last emails out to a VC. And there's just so much happening. Like, the deal's getting done. Like, where are you at, brother? And I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this. And he's just like, dude, write this letter, write this email. You don't have to worry about personalizing too much. Like, you're trying to tell them about the business and get them excited. I accidentally sent it to every single VC. Like, I copied and pasted, and I just pasted every person into the 2 box and hit send. And it was one of those things where I was just like, oh my God. Like, as soon as I hit send, I saw the 2 box. I thought I had just like the first persons in there. I was going to send it. And then like, I was going to send the email. And then I got this really cool tool called Yam that lets you do like mail merging without having to unsubscribe. So it looks like it's coming from you instead of like an email system like HubSpot. And my goal is just to send it to one person and then use that email as a template and just, I was going to paste this whole list into a spreadsheet. A, that is so embarrassing. But B, like, those are all burned. So I was like, hey guys, can you hop on a call real quick to my co-founders? And I was like, I just emailed the entire potential VC list. They literally saw every other VC I was talking to. But luckily, this was like right in the heart of YC. So I'd already been told no by 120 people. So we were trying to do this thing where we were trying to get like our fundraising round done before YC ended. We were trying to like preempt the whole thing. How we solved the mistake was, I can't sell it to everybody in YC. I just blew our chances at preempting our round. So I just got to go out and absolutely sell the piss out of this thing. And so that was one of those moments where I was like, I am not left with a lot of directions to go. The only direction to go is to go sell. And what was nice about that is like, that was the mistake that let us break free of where we were, because we were trying to sell to engineers, right? Like, that was the additional conversations I had to have to realize the potential of what we'd built, because we couldn't see it. We were too close to it.
Let's move forward then. So tell me what the future looks like for MassDriver, for the company and for the product.
For the company, we're actually, again, we're in one of these places where we've fallen ass backwards into something. So 6 weeks ago, I said this at the top of the call, it's like we were in our lowest of lows. We used to have a really great open rate on our emails. It was something like 70-something percent. We had a really good go-to-market, and our whole outbound strategy just got eviscerated by AI. So like, we used to do hyper-personalized emails, like, to which I don't think many companies do. Like, my background, like from back in the day, is high throughput web crawlers. I still have some little web crawling technology that I've built. We were doing something like 17 million websites a day. When we first started doing our outbound, what we would do is I pretty much took my crawler and I would run it against job boards, and I would build these architectural diagrams of what their cloud footprint looked like and what their team makeup looked like. One of the features of my web crawler is the ability to use the Wayback Machine to see differences in pages, how they change over time. So we were able to get an idea of like how long it took these people to place their operations roles. So like, we were able to come in with this rich amount of information. And what we would do is we take all that and we'd say, hey, we're looking at some of your job postings. We see that you guys are doing this, that, and the other. That was like our foot in the door. But we'd be able to go in and be like, hey, we see on average it takes you guys about 6 months to place an operations role, right? Like, you can see where this is going. But AI has just ruined email for everybody, right?
I don't think anybody checks it anymore. So we did that a little bit through LinkedIn as well, but it's just much harder through LinkedIn because you don't have as much like characters and you got to hope the person connects, right? The past year has been hard on the team as far as like getting our outbound. And we go to conferences, and last year we did reInvent. We did 1,400 demos in 4 days. We did them all on iPads. And we had this little tracker that would keep track of how many demos we did. So we're building Kubernetes clusters on an iPad, which is wild. And people are just blown away. But email is the curse, right? So we finished reInvent. We got 1,400 email addresses. We're like, great. If we can close 2% of this, we're going to go raise a Series A. We only got 3 sales calls booked. Like, people were blown away by what we were doing. We just couldn't get through the email. So much email goes out the day after reInvent. There's just so much bullshit. And like our open rates are like 10%. Man, like what? Like we spent so much money on reInvent to only get 3 sales out of it. We were doing KubeCon earlier this year and we're planning the same thing. We'll do it on iPads. And then we get to KubeCon and again, like falling ass backwards in the stuff. They didn't attach our TV to the wall. So we usually play this really awesome graphic cartoon. One of my best friends is a producer and director, and our sales guy's best friend is a comic book illustrator. So we do a lot of comic book illustrations for all the art for Mass Driver. And so we play that on this big screen. It always attracts people's attention. They come up and then we can show them the demo on the iPad, but they didn't mount our screen. And it was instead on this little stand thing pointing out into the aisleway. And so Dave's just like, this is pointing the aisle. He's like, I'm just going to do the demo on this big screen. And now what starts happening is groups of people start forming around the monitor while he's demoing. They start talking to each other about the demo. And we hear what they're saying. We hear what the people that like the demo are saying to the people that disagree with what they're seeing in the demo. And we see a couple of people convince them. That is one of those moments where we're like, oh, that's wild. Right. And so now we go into reInvent and we'd set our goal of like the number of sales calls that we wanted to book. And now we're taking this idea of we're going to do big demos and we're going to use the words of the people that were in our audience talking other people into the idea. And so our language changed. Nothing about our demo changed. We hit 20 times our goal. We hit our goal in the first hour of reInvent. And so now we're just like, we have more sales calls than we've ever had in our life. And so like our biggest stress right now is A, like we ran out of calendar spots. People are literally in line to book deep dives with their team at our booth. People are leaving because they're waiting in line so long. And so we've got this like level of success now that we've never seen. How do we process this? Like, how do we not panic and scale our team too quickly? How do we find that right moment when we need to bring on more people? That's the big thing. So like we were planning on doing like KubeCon EU in April, and now we've scratched it. We were planning on starting our Series A in January, and now we've scratched it. And so the next 3 months, we're like, okay, let's literally just focus on this massive batch of inbound that we've had and see what kind of business we have at the end of March before we go raise a round and before we do any more conferences. So it's wild. It's freeing. It's a curse at the same time. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a stressful couple of months. It's not that rocket hockey stick up and to the right in sales yet, but it is absolutely a hockey stick in inbound interest and like people that are already like sales qualified leads already for us. The next 3 months, like we're a sales org.
I got one more question, Corey. You're getting on a plane. And you're sitting next to a young entrepreneur who's built the next big thing. They're jazzed about it. They can't wait to show it off to the world and can't wait to show it off to you right there on the plane. What advice do you give that person, having gone down this road a bit?
Well, first off, I probably got my headphones and my eye mask on. So I'm asking, hey, why are you pulling on my elbow, dude? Or I'm in the car because I don't like flying. The first thing I do is I'd want to listen to him. All of us have a lot of advice to give. And I think a lot of times we can be irresponsible with giving our advice before we understand what the person's problem is. And one of the things that I've learned through all of our advisors and our investors is like everyone has an opinion. None of those opinions matter until you realize what you did was wrong. So I think the first thing is like to make sure you understand like where they need help and where you can give them advice that's really actionable and effective for them. And if they need your advice, right? I think a lot of times, like when you've had success, you could feel like you need to give advice. And sometimes you don't. you know, if they built the hot next thing and they're like looking for VCs, you can look at labels all day long. You can look at the logos. But what I'd be looking at is the people in those investment firms and finding that person that has the closest profile to you or your customer and talking to them. I think you're going to have a much easier pitch. You're going to have more interesting conversation because they understand your space. And you'll hopefully end up with a partner there that can really help and not just throw money at stuff. Like, money is great, but you're inevitably going to be underwater at some point in time in a place where money is not going to get you above water. And that's where that partnership comes in. And I'd say also, like, when looking at your VCs, make sure they're not full of shit. We have some VCs that I tried to reach out to. They said, oh, we help with go-to-market. We do all this great stuff. And then, like, after you get their money, you don't hear from them again. And that's fine. Like, you're going to have some of those. What you want to make sure is you don't have all of those. You really want to make sure that you have somebody on that cap table that can do more than just hand you cash, because there's going to be so many places where you don't know what to do. So I think that's it. It's just like, be really careful about who you choose for your partner and realize they got a lot of capital to spend. They also have a lot of capital to raise. They want to have good relationships. If you've got the hot new thing, everybody's going to be throwing money at you. And that's a problem in and of itself, is trying to pick that right money, right? And if you look at a logo and you go, oh, and I'm not saying Sequoia is bad, I'm just saying it's like what the one that everybody recognizes, right? If you're looking at it and you're saying, oh, they want to give me money, make sure that the partner you're going to get is like the right partner for you. Or if you're just like, hey, I want that, and the partner's not the right one, make sure whoever isn't your lead is like your go-to. Like, they can help you out.
And all of that is fantastic advice. Well, Corey, thank you for being on the show today. Thank you for telling the creation story of MassDriver.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And this concludes another chapter of Code Story. Code Story is hosted and produced by Noah Laphart. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And when you get a chance, leave us a review. Both things help us out tremendously. And thanks again for listening.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.